Good evening, everyone. Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here, though I feel a little out of place as a social scientist in this building. But I have to say I will be partaking a different approach, arriving at very much the same conclusions as you've just heard, with calling for greater mobility, more funding, and lighter regulation. So my task, I wanted to focus on, I was doing as instructed, focusing on the opportunities and threats for the research community, and I'm thinking particularly of universities posed by Brexit. And it seems to me at the moment that we are in something of a phony war. And I'm a social scientist, and I like data, and there isn't much. And what we have is pretty muddy. So when someone pulls out of a job search and blames Brexit, is it really Brexit, or did they really want to pull out anyway? Did their wife not want to come? Was it Brexit? Was it something else? Was it a combination? We don't really know. When somebody leaves and takes up a job offer in their home country in the EU and claims it's because of Brexit, is it really? Is it because they were homesick, wanted to go back? Is it Brexit? Is it something else? Is it a combination? You know, we don't know. When European colleagues tell their UK collaborators that they no longer want the UK academics as PIs or coordinators of ERC projects and claim it's because of Brexit, is it really Brexit, or is it because they want to be the PI? Is it something else? Again, yet we just don't know. Now, universities like mine, and I don't doubt a great many others, are suffused with anecdotes like this. But it's very hard to gather systematic data. We're trying to, but we won't get any really reliable data. And in any event, the numbers are going to be fairly small. But what I can say is that, intangible and unquantifiable as it is, stories like this are circulating, and they're having a corrosive effect on the fabric of our university communities. The result of the referendum was treated, we won't talk about the American election, the result of the referendum was really treated with shock and surprise. Just to give you an indication of the emotional reaction to this, after a couple of weeks after the referendum, I thought it might be an idea to sit down with some EU staff and chat with them. And I sent out, this was in the middle of July, when there aren't usually all that many people around, I sent out an email about 9 o'clock in the morning saying I'd be happy to sit down at 1 o'clock on Thursday and chat about the referendum if anybody wanted to come and chat. And I booked a room that holds 150 people, thinking that we'd probably have 75. Asked people to register just in case. And I was traveling at the time, so I got this at before 10 o'clock. I got an email saying, the room is full, we've closed off accepting people to come to your session on Thursday. So I said, no, if there's that kind of interest, just let anybody who wants to come, we'll find a bigger room. So then I got this absolutely delightful series of emails. You won't believe it, but it's 300. Oh God, it's 400. It's 500. By lunchtime, 1,400 people had signed up. We don't have a building big enough for that. So we moved to the Sheldonian Theatre and had a waiting list of several hundred people. And when I went out of my office to go into the Sheldonian, the queue was right down Broad Street. So I tell you that story just to give an indication of the emotional reaction to this referendum and the sense of concern and threat. Now, this can be dismissed as hysteria, but the fact is it's real, and people are really worried. After a while, people started to relax a little. It became clear that nothing was going to happen quickly, but still our European colleagues remained on edge. And then came the press reports that academics at the LSE were told that non-British EU citizens would not be allowed to offer advice to the British government on negotiating Brexit. And then this was followed by the Conservative Party conference, of which the Prime Minister declared famously, "If you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what the very word citizenship means." Now, this reignited all the fears that were just beginning to be allayed across our university, and I expect a great many others. I'll just read you one of the many, many emails I received after that speech. It read, "I'm a Dutch national who moved to the UK almost 6 years ago to work at this university. Initially, I felt very much at home, so much so that my wife and I had our third child here in Oxford. I never imagined I would write this, but I feel increasingly unwelcome and am now seriously considering returning to the continent. It's bad enough to feel unwelcome as a migrant, but to be unwelcome as an academic is even worse. News stories like this one on the FCO apparently not wanting non-British academics to provide advice feel like being hit by a bus. Many of our students, staff and academics at Oxford consider themselves citizens of the world. I know I do. According to our Prime Minister, currently one of the most prominent alumni of this university, that means that I don't understand what citizenship is. As an NHS blood donor, chair of governors for my local school, taxpayer with a 100% employment record, and as, if I may say so myself, a slightly boring but all-around nice guy, I am deeply hurt and infuriated by the Prime Minister's words, I'm planning to return to the Netherlands." So that just gives you a sense of what we're hearing. Speaking personally, as somebody born and raised in Ireland, spent my academic career in the US, then moved to Scotland and am now down in England, I might be considered a citizen of the world, but I actually think of citizenship of the world as an aspiration, not as a criticism, and see no conflict between citizenship of Ireland or Britain and citizenship of the world. And indeed, I would say that even the Church of England and all Christian churches and indeed most religions, their fundamental principle is the equality of individuals. I would thought one could read many of our religions as encouraging us to be citizens of the world. And it's, of course, it is the basis of all the human rights legislation internationally that has been written since the Second World War. Anyway, my point here is simply that as we think about the data on the impact of Brexit, we should not forget the human dimension. And those of us running British universities certainly cannot afford to do so. Before leaving the referendum, just another quick point. I think that the fact that a highly educated, but dare I say, unscrupulous politician could say we've had enough of experts, and that that could find such resonance, is not just an indictment of the person who said it, but I think it is something of an indictment of us too. It's clear evidence that those of us who consider ourselves experts spend a little too much time talking to one another and not enough time trying to convince the public of the value of our expertise. Certainly we at elite universities clearly have not spent the time we should convincing the public of the value of our universities as drivers of the economy, as engines of social mobility, as the source for so many of the medical and scientific discoveries that have improved all our lives. So I think we have to cease assuming that the value of our work is self-evident, and we have to be much more self-conscious in making a case for it. British universities, as we know, are one of the great success stories of the era. Three of the top 10 universities in the world are British. Six of the top 10 universities in Europe, seven of the top 11 universities in Europe are British. And incidentally, I don't shy away from the term elite for a moment. Elitist yet, but not elite. I cannot fathom why elite is an accolade when applied to a football team and a criticism when applied to a university. But anyway, what is the secret of this success of British universities? It isn't wealth. Oxford has the largest endowment of any university in Europe, and it is a fifth of Harvard's, a quarter of Stanford's, Yale's, Princeton, and so on. So it isn't wealth. I think it's actually quite simple. It's our ability to attract the best faculty, our ability to attract the best students, and our ability to create an environment in which they can thrive and do their work. This rapidly becomes a virtuous circle because, of course, the top academics attract others anxious to work with them, attract students willing to learn from them, and so it becomes mutually reinforcing. But we operate in a globalised marketplace, competing globally for students, for academics, and even university leaders. And this competition has become more expensive. It has always been a challenge to match American salaries when we're trying to recruit universities from there, but it's just become 15% more expensive with the decline in the value of the pound, and I fear it may become even more expensive again. There are legions of examples of increasing mobility amongst academics and researchers. The proportion of Oxford's international staff has increased by two-thirds since 2003, and now 48% of our academics are from outside the UK. 63% of our graduate students are from outside the UK. So international mobility is vitally important to our success. And much of the success of British institutions has been built on European foundations. During the EU's previous framework programme, which ran from 2007 to 2013, the UK received €3.4 billion more in funding than it contributed. The current framework programme, Horizon 2020, is making available nearly €80 billion, the largest fund ever available. Oxford's funding so far under Horizon 2020 totals more than €200 million, with €100 million of that through the European Research Grants. European Research Council grants. One example of the value of EU funding is that of quantum computing, which has the potential to dwarf the processing powers of today's conventional computers. The potential applications are legion. The discovery of new drugs, for example, will be speeded up as quantum computers simulate different molecules rather than each molecule having to be created in a lab. It can be applied also to problems around climate and economics as well as health. Or if you like reading books as I do, it's like I'm told reading all the books in the Bodleian simultaneously rather than one at a time. One of the early breakthroughs in quantum computing took place in the 1990s by a Polish graduate student, now a professor of mathematics in the UK. And as the research developed, it was supported by European framework programmes beginning in 1998 and continuing to this day. At least half a dozen of the European researchers currently working on the project in Oxford are supported by Marie Curie Awards. Many more European researchers are being supported simultaneously at associated research centres around the UK. The University's Minister, Jo Johnson, visited the project earlier this year because the government had declared quantum technologies as a national scientific priority. He was met at the door by one of our postgrads, who, of course, was EU-funded and was a German national. So, as you heard earlier from Venki, our ability to remain competitive as globally is linked to our ability to attract scholars from around the world. And the easier they can move here, the easier it would be to attract them. So we need fewer and not more constraints on international mobility. For Oxford, and forgive all the Oxford examples, they're the ones I'm familiar with, but we've been asked to talk about the threat. So the threat Brexit poses to us comes in three directions. First, students. 15% of our students are citizens of the EU. We're delighted that we can guarantee them, both those starting this year and applying this year for next, that they will pay EU fees into the future, or home fees into the future. But we have to assume that after that, they will have to pay international fees and the numbers will decline. Now, we will engage in aggressive fundraising to try and fix that delta, but we can reasonably assume that that number will decline. Like Venki, I cannot understand why these students are included in the net migration figures. We have lobbied assiduously on this for years to no effect. I'd like to suggest that maybe we should try to focus our energies on persuading the government, at least when they release the net migration figures, that they present EU students separately. So if the announcement were that net migration was 325,000, for example, but to stipulate in that same sentence that 160,000 of those are students, would at least help separate in the public mind the students from the issue of migration. The second point is staff. The second threat to us comes in the form of our staff. I mentioned already just how nervous they are about this. 17% of our staff are citizens of the EU. Most of them are eminently poachable. Many European governments, many European universities are doing what we would do in their situation and trying to poach them, notwithstanding all the public talk of collaboration. There's poaching going on, and we're vulnerable, and we would do the same in their situation. The recent budget by the Irish government has created a fund purely for this purpose. So Germany, Ireland and the Netherlands are likely to be the biggest gainers here, and we will lose our staff. We have started losing staff. As I said earlier, it's very difficult to have good data on that. So for our staff, we want for them the right to remain, and I would say that we would like this as soon as possible for the government to clarify that all of those in the UK on EU passports can remain. It will be deeply divisive in our communities if we are to draw a distinction between those who work in our kitchens versus those who teach our students. We are dependent on migrants at all level of the university. We value all of them, and we're certainly not prepared to lobby for differential treatment for those currently here, depending on the degree of skills they brought with them. So for our students, we want them outside the net migration figures, and we would like them to be able to stay on and work after they've graduated. For all the reasons Venki outlined, they will be contributors to our economy. For staff, we want the right to remain both unskilled and skilled, and we want movement as free as possible. The biggest concern, of course, is research. 12% of our research funding comes from the European Research Council. That was £67 million last year. So we appear to have two options. One is to bring back the £1 billion net of net EU funding and distribute it here. Let the British Research Councils distribute it here. Venki suggested a twist on this could be that we would ring-fence some of that for international collaborations. The other option, and certainly our preferred option, is to buy in to the current, to allow ourselves to buy into the current arrangements, current frameworks. We worry if the money were brought back here, and we realise this is most likely to be, likely politically to be more popular in Whitehall. For us, that's less desirable. The money isn't entirely fungible. The kind of research that the ERC, for example, supports is fairly unfettered. They are far more generous to the humanities and the social sciences than are our national research councils. They're much more willing to support blue skies research, much more willing to support research that isn't tied to government priorities. And we're concerned that which I can see from Whitehall's point of view would be an advantage, but if the money were brought back and distributed nationally, we worry that it would be tied too closely to current and ephemeral government priorities, and we'd lose out on blue skies research, we'd lose out on funding for humanities and social sciences. So our preference is definitely to buy into the current arrangement. Our preference is as little change from the current arrangement as possible, in fact. We'd also like to be able to retain the ability to shape and as well as participate in European collaborations. It goes without saying, of course, that so many of the issues that we work on, whether it's disease, aging, terrorism, literature, these are all impervious to national boundaries, and they require different national perspectives to understand them better. If we wish to participate in Horizon 2020 and future framework programs, we're going to have to negotiate some form of associate country status. Turns out there's no simple template for associate country agreement. Each one varies. And, of course, the US position is unique, as no other country has formally left the EU before. So free movement of people is currently being cited as a reason why the UK may not be granted access to Horizon 2020 and future framework programs. And this is tends to be based on the experience of Switzerland being excluded when it restricted free movement. But of the current 15 associated countries, free movement of non-EU nationals within the EU applies only in some cases. Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway, although these countries are not members of the EU, their nationals can work in the EU on the same footing as EU nationals because they belong to the European Economic Area. Switzerland, under the EU-Switzerland Agreement on the Free Movement of Persons, Swiss nationals are free to live and work in the EU. Georgia, the latest country to join Horizon 2020, has an agreement that explicitly mentions the need for ensuring the free movement of research workers in the section on cooperation in research, technological developments, and demonstrations. And then Israel. Israel first became an associated country for EU funding in 1996 and has negotiated this status for each subsequent framework program, including Horizon 2020. There's no mention of free movement of people as a requirement for participation. So the best option would appear to be an agreement broadly similar to those with Israel or Georgia. And indeed, given the strength of UK research and our prominence in Europe, it may be possible to identify a new form of association in Horizon 2020, access to research programmes plus the ability to influence future research policy in the EU. We should, it may be wishful thinking, but we should try for it. So I think those preparing to negotiate our exit from the EU have to understand that full access to Horizon 2020 and subsequent programmes, including the right to host ERC grants and to coordinate projects, is critical for the continued success of British higher education. There is no legal link between single market access, the four freedoms, and participation in Horizon 2020. It is simply politics. But just to remind ourselves what did happen in the case of Switzerland. Switzerland, tiny country and yet has one of the top 10 universities in the world, has two of the top 10 universities in Europe, has far and away the highest success rate in applying for EU grants, higher even than the top performing British university, which is Cambridge. Many of you know that Switzerland has been integral to EU framework programs for decades. Since 2004, it has enjoyed associate country status, which gives it more or less the same right to bid for funding and participate in research as EU members. But in 2014, the Swiss voted in a referendum to restrict free movement across its borders with the European Union, and the EU removed its associate country status, demonstrating a willingness to use a country's status within research programs as a political lever. Now, the immediate effect on Swiss research was dramatic. It declined dramatically. The number of research programs in which Switzerland took part had risen every year, uninterrupted, for decades. It peaked at 745 in 2013. Then came the referendum, and by 2015, it had dropped to 307. That's a 60% drop. Other statistics tell the same story. Switzerland participated in 3.2% of research programs during Framework 7, which ran from 2007 to 2013. In Horizon 2020, which replaced Framework 7, they're taking part in 1.8%. They got 4.2% of the money from Framework 7. They are getting 2.2% from Horizon 2020. So this is not a pretty picture. We don't know if the EU will try to adopt the same tactic with us, just as we have an incentive to take as hard a position as possible now, so do they. But it seems clear that the Swiss example is not an encouraging one. So notwithstanding that bleak picture, we've been asked to identify opportunities as well as threats, and there are some, though my list is much shorter. One of the drawbacks we know, and again, Venki mentioned this, one of the drawbacks of the EU is the weight of regulation and slow speed of change. Regulation in some of the areas he mentioned, areas like clinical trials, data protection, privacy, GM crops, VAT rules, and so on. These have all been experienced here as inhibiting innovation. Now, if, and it is a very big if, from a government that declares itself to be a deregulatory government but has shown little or no evidence in support of this claim. But if we could adopt a lighter touch, risk-based and speedy regulatory environment as distinct from the heavy hand of Brussels, then we could be at a real competitive advantage. If the government decides upon an industrial strategy that plays to our strengths, such as life sciences, energy, digital, data, and increases the funding of scientific research, raising it at least to the average, and when have we ever been satisfied with average, but even the average across the G8, which is 0.77% as compared to our current 0.48%, then we could see real energy and innovation and driving the British economy. So, in short, then, I think we need to, or say we at universities need to reassure our EU colleagues that they are valued. We need to negotiate for free movement of people. We need to get our students out of the net migration figures, or at the very least, presented separately. We need to try to negotiate for associate country status. We need increased public funding for our research. We need an industrial strategy that plays to our strengths. We need to prove that we are, in fact, a deregulatory government. And we need to make the case of the value of what we do to society at large. And if we manage to do all that, I'm sure we will end up delighted that we voted for Brexit. Thank you.